Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 74 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 71 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
حملت دمي على كفي وما ركزت صمت العشب الأخضر فوق قبور أسلافي أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم 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 أناديكم
Good afternoon, everybody. That was the song Unadikum by Ahmed Kabur. It's calling out people in Lebanon to resist. We're going to be talking, obviously, about the story of the week and rather of the recent attack on of blowing up pagers in Lebanon, and that continued to the destruction of also like blowing up laptops, solar panels, and walkie-talkies. And obviously that right now we have hundreds of injuries. There's about 2,800 explosions that went off, hundreds of injuries, about 12 dead so far, including a 10-year-old girl. Obviously, these are pagers that are were blown up in public places, meaning it is you know, the U.S. tries to gaslight such things with their bragging about technology, because as I spoke with one special ops guy, he was telling me he justified everything that the U.S. does by their high tech, that since they are technologically advanced, that means they're civilized. Obviously, that is not the case. We are living here in the United States in this most uncivilized nation. And I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about a government that supports genocide, that feeds genocide, that is responsible for the genocide that's happening in Gaza. Now, I know there's demoralization, and rightly so, happening because of this uncertainty where people don't know when if their own devices are going to blow up in Lebanon. And there is no doubt about this. This is a major act of terrorism, as the president of Belgium framed it. It has to be dealt with as such. Strategically, in the long term, it does not change anything. It is, you know, this might be a precursor to the war they've been threatening against Lebanon since October. There's been several threats, but this might be something that's preempting it. Another angle on the story is that these things were discovered, that these devices or whatever was implanted in these devices there, that was part of the you know, now the biggest suspicion falls on the supply chain network, which is very complicated for tech supplies. And so somewhere along the supply chain, these devices were basically planted with explosives. The one of the stories is that they were beginning to realize this, and Israel had to set them off basically to destroy the evidence. So that's what's happening. This falls, of course, hand in hand with the threat that that Israel has been making about, the expansion of the war, for sure. But also, like, this is in the past week, they have been hit several times by, first of all, by Yemen, and of course by Lebanon, and they're trying to get clear out the northern part of the occupied territories adjacent to Lebanon to bring the settlers back into them. And there's a promise for that. But at the end of the day, this is what it's all about. And it's about Netanyahu. It's the same old story. It's about Netanyahu wanting an endless war, because as soon as this war ends, he's going to have to answer for his incompetence on October 7th. He's going to have to answer for his actually funding Hamas before October 7th, sending them suitcases of money, or rather briefcases of money. He's going to have to answer to the corruption that he's facing in the Israeli courts themselves. And of course, he's going to have to face the families of the hostages. At every turn, they're asked, whenever you say something about the genocide and about the killing of children and women and men, about the which has exceeded over 100,000 now killed Palestinians, you are met with the question, what about the hostages? Well, the truth about the hostages, and everybody knows this, including the families of the hostages, they're realizing now that actually Netanyahu doesn't want the hostages to be released alive. He wants them dead. And they've already killed several hostages themselves. The problem, the real problem with this is the fact that what are the hostages? What stories are they going to tell? First, what stories are they going to tell about October 7th, where they were hit by their own Apache helicopters and by their own artillery, basically by Israeli artillery, when Israel activated the Hannibal directive, which means you kill the hostages along with their captors. So that's one thing. The other thing that Netanyahu fears, if the hostages are released, is that they'll talk about their treatment by the resistance forces in Palestine, in the sense that as previous hostages have been released, they have talked about how well they were treated. And while the lies about mass rapes were happening, hostages were talking about how a well-respected and unharmed they were in that captivity by these men. And to as an example of one story on Israeli media, where a captive said, "We were allowed to exercise. We were allowed to." They respected our privacy, and they even she talked about a story that really tells you who is obeying international law and who is massacring civilians and raping prisoners, which is it's clear now that it is Israel. But this woman actually talked about the being allowed this hostage, Israeli hostage, being allowed to exercise, including challenging Hamas fighters with arm wrestling. And when she was asked to talk about that, she said that they arm wrestled, but they actually used the towel because they're not allowed to touch the women. And they, these are people who would not shake hands with these women. This is while the lies about mass rapes are being passed by the Israeli authorities and by the demented Biden, and are continue to be mentioned by Kamala Harris, another all of them Monsters Inc. Are talking about it. They're still trying to pass it on, and contrast that with the actual evidence, photographic evidence of Palestinians being raped in prisons, and the multiple stories that have been happening way before October 7th of the rape of men, women, and children, which one State Department official who had quit talked about trying to investigate the rape of children, Palestinian children, in Israeli prisons. And they were, response to that, they shut down the NGO, the human rights organization that was trying to investigate it, and kicked them out of the country. So this is the contrast we have. So with that, I wanted to share with you the sit-rep by the anti-empire broadcast, basically. This is he's talking about, in general, what has been happening. And then he goes into detail about this exploding pager issue in Lebanon. And also I wanted to make sure that people know that hospital workers in Lebanon have been injured because they have to carry these pagers, and some of the doctors, I'm told, are refusing to abandon some of these same type of pagers because they need them for their patients. This is their only way of contact and response. So there are still people risking their lives by carrying these pagers because they have to respond to all kinds of emergencies until a new set of manufacturers. And that's what I want to draw your attention, is that in the long term, what is the implication for these, for basically tech, for the tech industry in the United States and in Europe, as opposed to switching to an alternative, a safer alternative that's not allied with the state of Israel, to, for example, Chinese produced products and such. In the long term, this is gonna be a loss. This is gonna impact that kind of tech industry. Let them celebrate today, and they'll be crying tomorrow. And let's hear the anti-empire podcast talking about the pager Lebanon issue.
Gaza War Day 347. You guys knew I'd be here the other day, and I'm sure tonight you knew I'd be back. We have to talk about the pager attack. But let's get some other stuff out of the way first. In terms of our usual no end in sight report, I mean, do I need to say more? But we will talk about we do need to talk about the fact that Israel is now recruiting Navy personnel for army duties, as well as offering some kind of temporary asylum arrangement for African refugees, asylum seekers, 30,000 of them in Israel, who are being offered a chance to get some status in Israel. Of course, Israel is a thoroughly racist country in terms of racism against Africans. There was unbelievable racism against Africans when years ago there were a lot of asylum seekers that were going to Israel, and some of the stuff that was said and publicly done at that time was, people who know what Israel is now, a lot of people know what it is now, would probably understand what was going on then. But at the time, it was pretty shocking because there were a lot of illusions about Israel being something other than what it is. Okay, so Israel's personnel problems, recruiting issues are definitely not gone away. And they're searching for other sources of people, of troops. And so, okay. So now you remember the other 2 days ago, we talked about the missile. It was called the Palestine 2. It turned out Yemen produced a video about it, of the launch of it and everything. It was the, I guessed that it was the Palestine missile because they tested that missile and they said that it was a hypersonic ballistic missile. And so they showed the launch of that and its range, and it hit, I guess, Tel Aviv at the end of its range, 2000 and some kilometers, and travels, they said, at Mach 18. So way, so many times faster than the speed of sound. It's very hypersonic, for those that follow the technology a bit. Solid fuel missile, which is not common in the world. I'm told that very few countries have solid fuel technology, and Yemen is among them, apparently. So Nasser al-Din Amr, the vice president of the Ansarullah Media Authority, told the Shahab agency yesterday, I think, "We are ready to send hundreds of thousands of trained fighters to Hezbollah if needed, and we will support them in the same way that we support our brothers in the resistance in Palestine. We aim to expand our capability to strike any target across the entire territory of occupied Palestine, and we are working on this at a fast pace. Yesterday's missile is not part of the response to the bombing of Hodeidah port, and likewise, the Yaffa drone will not be used for isolated strikes in response only. Rather, it will be part of ongoing operations until the aggression on Gaza stops." Once again, you see the resistance axis tying publicly the end of their operations against Israel to the end of aggression on Gaza. There's no other way for Israel to get out of being attacked from Hezbollah, from Ansarullah, besides from Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq. There's no other way besides making, ending the aggression and withdrawing from Gaza and ending the siege of Gaza, which is one of Yemen's specific conditions. I mentioned that Yahya Sinwar had written a message to Malik Houthi, and it was a strong message, I would say. So we have now, ever since Ismail Haniyeh died and Yahya Sinwar became the overall leader of Hamas, we have more of these direct messages. I mean, Ismail Haniyeh made these kinds of communications, so it makes sense that Sinwar is. It's just strange to have Sinwar from underground sending these open public messages, but that's the reality of the situation. They have Abu Ubaida as the Qassam spokesman, and then they have messages coming directly from Yahya Sinwar to different leaders of the resistance, including Sayyid Abdel Malik Badr al-Din al-Houthi, who I've been calling Malik Houthi. "Our people," Sinwar says, writes, "our people in the Gaza Strip are living between the hardship of aggression and siege and the valiant resistance led by Al-Qassam Brigades. Al-Qassam Brigades carried out the October 7th attack with unmatched skill and have been waging a defensive battle for an entire year, exhausting the enemy and inflicting heavy damage. I assure you," so Yahya Sinwar assuring Malik Houthi, "that the resistance is strong and what the enemy is claiming is nothing but lies and psychological warfare. We have prepared ourselves for a long war of attrition that will break the enemy's political will, just as the Al-Aqsa flood broke their military will." This, I think, is one of the strongest clues to the overall strategy that the resistance is pursuing here. We have prepared ourselves for a long war of attrition that will break the enemy's political will, just as the Al-Aqsa flood broke their military will. So just chew on that as I finish this letter. Our combined efforts with you and with our valiant brothers in the resistance in Lebanon and the Islamic resistance in Iraq will break this enemy and bring about its defeat. So Yahya Sinwar, I think I went over his novel a few sit reps ago. It's pretty clear that Yahya Sinwar understands the war with Israel as a battle of wills. And he understands, as the commander of this battle, that victory means breaking their political will. Their military will is broken already. So they're not the dominant military force that they were before. That's their self-image is shattered. Their image before the world is shattered. But they have this political will to go on and on. They have the will to sacrifice the prisoners. They have the will to commit unbelievable acts of depravity, including the one today. And they have the will to defy international opinion, to defy public, the public, to defy the parts of the Israeli public that are telling them to stop. And of course, to defy the entire global South, to defy the bloc in the West that is anti-genocide. They have the will to, they have the political will to defy all of those. And that is going to be broken by a long war of attrition, according to Yahya Sinwar in this letter to Malik Houthi. So let's finish with the war of attrition and the sit rep today before we get into the pager attack. So in the West Bank, there's fighting in Nablus, explosive devices in Balata, fighting with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, who are out there disarming explosive devices that are planted to fight the Israelis. There's fighting in Tulkarm. So there's continuous fighting in the West Bank, continuous reports of fighting in the West Bank. In Gaza, there was a big massacre in Burej, so one of the Israeli daily massacres. And there's fighting in Rafah. There was what the Israelis call a difficult incident in the Philadelphia corridor, in which at least 4 Israeli soldiers were killed. So, and the helicopters came and picked up the Israeli evacuees. So that's the fighting in West Bank and Gaza in occupied Palestine. That's the letter from Yahya Sinwar to Malik Houthi. And that's some of the debriefing that Yemen made over the missile attack with their hypersonic ballistic Palestine 2 missile a couple days ago. Now we get to Lebanon and this pager attack. So for those who don't know, and I'm not sure how you don't know, but if especially I'm pretty sure everybody who's here tonight knows, but if you don't know, 3,000 plus pagers in Lebanon and in Syria, some in Syria, a couple dozen in Syria, exploded all at the same time. Israel is gloating on it. They didn't officially take responsibility, but they're gloating about it in all their social media, making just hilarious jokes about all the brutal injuries that have resulted from these pagers exploding. So 2,800 plus wounded, 200 in critical condition, at least 9 killed, 1 10-year-old girl. So really devastating attack in terms of, like, as an act of terrorism, it's a very successful act of terrorism. If this was done by a cartoon villain, if there was a thriller plot written about a villain who was planning to blow up thousands of pagers at the same time with a radio frequency signal, and the heroes were trying to foil this attack, that would make a good plot for good guys to try to prevent a villain from blowing up all these pagers. So, who, we know more or less who did it. They didn't admit it, although they did admit it. They kind of joked about it. There's nobody else that it would possibly make sense who would do it or who could. Okay, how did they do it? There's different ideas floating around. I think, I'll tell you what I think, but I'll tell you the different theories. So one theory is that there was some kind of exploit in terms of the software where they could talk to the pager and convince the pager, the lithium battery in the pager, to overheat and explode. So Edward Snowden tweeted about this today, and Snowden doesn't think that that's how it works because, and I think this is probably right. This is just what I think. But he said that if that was the case, you would have seen a lot of small fires and a lot of misfires. And I don't know if anybody's ever been around. These things do happen by accident. Sometimes batteries do go on fire and sometimes they do explode. And, you know, they cause fires, they cause all kinds of damage, but it doesn't, to me, that doesn't seem quite right. So the other theory that's going around, and Hezbollah is doing their own investigation, so we will eventually find out. But the other theory is that the Israelis either intercepted a shipment of these pagers or have some kind of deal through American intelligence with the company Motorola that supplies these pagers. And they modified the pagers sometime before delivery, at the hardware level, and introduced some explosive material, a few grams of explosives into each pager that could then be triggered remotely. And that makes a lot more sense to me in terms of what Snowden said, in terms of the way hacking actually works. You know, there are software exploits for sure, but, you know, intelligence agencies, the type of hacking that they do, they like to do physical access. They like to do physical interception. They like to insert things into the devices. You may or may not know that a major resistance figure was assassinated by Israel with an exploding cell phone. It was in the 90s, I think, maybe the early 2000s. Inside history. There's an article today, Inside Israel's History of Inventive Assassination Methods. Mossad, oh, come on, you're paywalling me, really? Exploding Palestinian leader, let's see. I think it was, I don't want to say the name. I think I know the name, but I don't want to say the wrong name. Yeah, that's who I thought it was. Yahya Ayash. So Yahya Ayash, otherwise known as the engineer, and he was killed in 1996. I think John Elmer's mentioned Yahya Ayash on the Resistance Report many times. So he was assassinated by a booby-trapped cell phone. I mean, back then, the cell phones in 1996, cell phones were pretty big. You know, that's why I think it was a physical thing. And that it makes more sense to me because lots of pagers didn't blow up. The ones that blew up may have been from a batch that came sometime in the past months. So it was like a sleeper batch, right? So Israel had the ability to do this for months. They got this batch, they intercepted it, all these pagers they could have blown up, and then they blew it up. And there's an interesting question about why they blew it up now. Let me get to that in a second. Let's just talk about who uses pagers. Because I was skeptical even of the fact that maybe this wasn't even Hezbollah. Maybe this was just people with pagers. Because hospital staff use pagers, right? And I suspect it's like a dual use kind of thing. Pagers, you can get a page on a, you know, a radio network, I think. And then you get a page and then you call the person back, or you just send coded messages on using the pager, right? So you don't need to be on a cell phone network. You don't need to be on the internet, which Hassan Nasrallah explicitly warned people about in one of his speeches. He warned people against using using the internet and using those ring lights and those different recording devices and internet linked things. So pagers, you know, you could imagine pagers would be part of a communication system because Hezbollah has a wired telephone network, which they almost went to war over. I remember more than a decade ago, Nasrallah made a speech because the Lebanese government, at the behest of Israel at the time, was threatening to tear up the wired telephone network. And Nasrallah said, basically, if you're trying to attack our weapons that we need to defend the country against Israel, then you are a traitor and you'll be treated the same way as Israel. So needless to say, the authorities backed off of that after that speech. So pagers would be a part potentially of the way Hezbollah operates. If you're trying to avoid using cell phones, if you're trying to avoid using the internet for security purposes, this is an alternative. It's a simple system. And it's very on brand in terms of what Hezbollah does, right? They have low-tech solutions, resilient low-tech kinds of solutions, and pagers are possibly a part of that. But who else uses pagers? Remember, Hezbollah is not solely an underground network. It's not an underground organization. It's a political party. It's an openly functioning political party with all the things that really well-organized parties have in terms of clubs and societies and health care and education and all of these kinds of things. Hezbollah has all of these kinds of activities that they do. So they have above ground, it's a legal political party. And a lot of the people that were injured were from that. Some of the people who were killed were from totally above ground legal in Lebanon organizations. And some were had no affiliation whatsoever with Hezbollah, because who else uses pagers? Medical people use pagers. Medical people use pagers. They still use pagers. You page your doctor. You can still page your doctor. They don't all use cell phones because I think there's reasons why you can't have a cell phone in a hospital. Maybe I'll ask Tariq for more detail on why they still use pagers, but it might be because of the magnetic resonance imagers, or I don't know. There are probably some very good reasons why. But they do. Medical people use pagers. And so a lot of medical people were blown up today because they use pagers. And a lot of people were blown up because they were near pagers. So it's it was just a terrorism attack. It was just a terrorist attack. And, you know, I think history will show that, like a lot of things that Israel has been doing, it wasn't really worth it. What do I mean? Okay, I will get back to the question of why now. But in terms of the question of what were the benefits, what are the military benefits versus the military costs here? Let's analyze it in those terms. The military benefits are you potentially kill leaders, you cause, you create a moment of distrust in existing communication networks, which can create a larger panic or larger chaos, I guess, as people try to switch to less secure systems. People try to switch to backup systems. People may now worry about their other devices. So there's going to be a whole period of adjustment. And while that those adjustments are happening, presumably they'll be more vulnerable. Their command and control will be more vulnerable. Maybe there'll be more chances to infiltrate and exploit for Israel. Okay, military benefit. The actual murderousness of the attack is military benefit. If indeed this was a major tool that Hezbollah used, then you may have killed a bunch of Hezbollah people and wounded a whole bunch more, along with the civilians. Israel doesn't care. And as long as it's Israel doing it, nobody in the West cares whether tons of civilians or children are killed in the course of Israel killing who it wants. If they kill people that had nothing to do with it on the way to killing people they wanted to kill, nobody in the West cares. So none of those are costs. Those are all just benefits to them. Killing 20, wounding 3,000 people, critically injuring 200 people, killing at least 10 people, those are all benefits for Israel. That's what the kind of thing Israel celebrates. That's the kind of people Israelis are now. And so all of those can be in the benefit column. What about the costs? So in terms of the costs, when you use a trick like this, and this was a trick, you can't do it again, right? There's going to be a lot more scrutiny of the supply chain of any devices, of any communications. There's going to be an investigation. Hezbollah is going to get to the bottom of how this happened. And this trick was, it was used to good effect. But now I think it's going to cast a huge shadow of doubt over all Western tech. As people have tweeted, I think Syed Mohammed Morandi from Iran, he said, don't buy any phones or devices that were made in Taiwan or Japan or America that are part of that. There's an entire Korea, there's an entire chain, there's an entire supply chain of devices, which is like the cutting edge of all technology, in which China is competing with this whole East Asian / American alternative to China. And this is the chip war that you've probably heard about. There's a tech war that you've heard about. And America's organized, Taiwan and Korea, ultimately. Japan is already out of the game for the most part. But there's a stack, there's a system that the Americans are using to build out phones and computers and tablets and everything. And then there's Chinese alternatives, namely Huawei and others. And if you're in the global South, you got to go with the Chinese alternative now, right? So the other one could literally kill you. It's one thing to discover, as many European leaders discovered, thanks to the aforementioned Edward Snowden. It's one thing to discover that the Americans are using these devices to spy on you. It's one thing to discover that the Israelis have installed direct and undetectable software onto your device to spy on you and track you and stuff like that. Okay. I mean, the police are going to use your devices to spy on you and track you and arrest you for whatever they want to at some point in the West, right? That's what the West does. And surveillance of you through your phone is like one of the things that everybody just accepts in the West. It's another thing, you're the German leader, you're the Brazilian president, you're the German chancellor, you know that you're American device is spying on you and transmitting information to the Americans, fine, or the Israelis, fine. You're a South African leader, whatever, fine. But if this thing can blow up and kill you, that's a lot more to ask, right? It's a lot more. America can say, look, just run this, use this device. We're going to spy on you. It's a great device. You know, you can watch videos on it. You can tweet and do Instagram and take photos and watch TikToks and stuff. It's a great device. You can chat on it. You can receive electoral scientific misinformation on it right to your phone. You can receive pro-Israel propaganda right to your phone. You can watch genocide on your phone. So it's a great thing. You can't really do without it. Just accept that we're going to spy on you. Okay. Just accept that we're going to blow it up and kill you at some point, or that we can. And that's like one of the things that you have to accept might happen to you. That's a lot more to ask. That's a profound thing to ask. It's a heavy thing to ask. And I think a lot of people will, I think this could tip the balance for a lot of people in terms of which technological choices to make, whether to go with the Chinese option or the Western option, a lot of which is still made in China, but ultimately controlled by a supply chain controlled by the West, by the Americans. So that's a big cost. And that's the kind of cost that we won't see for a long time. That's the kind of cost that's going to emerge over a long period of time. It's going to unfold over the coming years, but it's going to emerge. It can't not. And those are ripples from this single day. This single day, Israel did more to undermine trust in American technology than probably any other single day in history. Because they actually killed people. Like, this is way bigger a deal than the Snowden revelations. So why did they do it today? There's a couple of things. There was, Israel said they foiled an assassination plot against one of their officials. Now, they may have said this in preparation for doing this today. But maybe it was real. Maybe they really found a bomb or something that was going to blow up one of their officials. Doesn't seem like that all that likely to me, but supposing that's true, maybe that was their decision. Okay, well then let's blow up all the pagers. Maybe they got a sense that this whole plot was going to be discovered. So if the plot's going to be discovered, you have to blow it up. I also don't see any signs that it was on the verge of being discovered, but you know, we won't know until Hezbollah makes their statement, and if any of those were true. Another one that I've heard is that Hezbollah made a very successful attack against Israeli intelligence a few days back. That was their retaliation for the assassination of Fawad Shukr. Israeli intelligence is the one who presumably intercepted these pagers and installed explosives in these pagers and set up this whole plot. So maybe they figured they would trigger it as a revenge for the revenge of Hezbollah for Fawad Shukr. Maybe. Maybe it's another sub-threshold alternative to trying to invade Lebanon. That's what Amal Saad thinks. Amal Saad being one of the most perceptive and knowledgeable watchers of this war. Amal Saad is a prof based in the UK. She's, I think, Lebanese background, and she wrote, I think, the book on Hezbollah, a really good book on Hezbollah called Hezbollah Politics and Religion that I yet read decades ago. Okay, so Amal Saad's thread: Israel's unprecedented and highly sophisticated security operation today, in which almost 3,000 people have been injured so far. This was 1 p.m. my time, so about 11 hours ago. is by all means a massive blow to Hezbollah. This is all the more so the case given that Hezbollah has always credited its performance in the July war to its primitive telecom network, which relied on pagers and a fiber optic internal line. By neutralizing Israel's technological superiority with simplicity, to borrow Nasrallah's terms, Hezbollah prevented Israel from disrupting its command and control system. Today's attack effectively negates this advantage. I think Amal Saad, who knows more than me, I admit, maybe overstating it here. I don't think it effectively negates the advantage. I think it, let's say, I would rather say it, it causes damage in spite of the advantage. Okay, so Amal Saad now is addressing why now. The question is, why did Israel choose to prematurely play this card outside the context of all-out war, where a disruption of this magnitude could have changed the course of the war? Again, I'm not sure it could have changed the course of the war. I don't see even a disruption of this magnitude being able to change the course of the war. It would do damage. Like, if you kill a commander, it makes a difference. If you kill a bunch of commanders, if you take out a whole unit somewhere, all of these things can happen in war. It wouldn't necessarily change the course of the war. Israel surely knows that Hezbollah will now review and amend its entire communication protocols, which suggests that Israel has other aims that could well fall short of war. So I agree with that. I agree with Amal Saad on that, that Israel knows that Hezbollah will now amend its communication protocols. The question is, does Hezbollah have to default to inferior options or what, right? They're going to have a period where they don't, however, even if it might even be over now, but there would be, after an attack like this, a period where you don't know exactly what is trusted and what's not and what else is coming. And that's a very vulnerable place to be. Amal continues, the operation appears to have been designed as a major spectacle, potentially serving dual purposes: to demoralize Hezbollah's cadres and instill uncertainty while acting as a coercive deterrent aimed at altering their force positioning on the border. It's not going to be a deterrent, so I don't think it's going to serve that purpose. Demoralization? Sure. Specific demoralization in your own technology, in your communication system, there's no way that's not going to happen. Israel appears, fourth and final tweet in the series, to have developed a unique military security paradigm in its war on Lebanon. Its daily assassination campaign via drone warfare blurs the line between prolonged security measures and traditional warfare. Today's attack consolidates this novel paradigm, which acts more as a substitute for all-out conventional war, at least for the time being. Again, I don't know. I don't know if they can substitute. They're talking a lot about this big war. We're seeing more and more signs of it. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they can navigate their way out of it. I think they're going, you know, I thought it was going to happen in the summer, so I'm not going to make any more predictions about it. I think you only get one. You're only allowed one prediction about a specific event. And so I've lost mine. I've played my card. But the various signs of an attack, you know, the way they're talking, this event, deeper kinds of hits into Lebanon that have been happening, all of these suggest that the war on Lebanon, the war between Israel and Lebanon, the ground war, is going to happen.
Thank you. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The United Nations General Assembly today adopted a Palestinian-drafted resolution that demands Israel withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territory within the next year. The resolution also calls on countries to take steps to prevent trade or investments that maintain Israel's presence in the territory, as well as to halt the transfer of arms and munitions to Israel if there are reasonable grounds to suspect that they may be used in the occupied Palestinian territory. 124 countries voted in favor of the resolution, while 43 countries abstained, and Israel, the United States, and 12 others voted no. The resolution is a response to a ruling by the top United Nations court in July that said Israel's presence in the Palestinian territories is unlawful and must end. And while today's General Assembly resolution is not legally binding, the extent of its support does reflect world opinion. In related news, several explosions went off today in Beirut during funerals for three Hezbollah members and a child who were killed by exploding pagers yesterday. A Hezbollah official told the AP that walkie-talkies used by the group exploded today. At least 12 people were killed by the pager attacks across Lebanon and Syria yesterday, including two children, and about 2,800 people were injured. The AP cited a U.S. official who said Israel placed small amounts of explosives in the pagers, which were made by a company based in Hungary. Israel has not commented on the attacks. Israeli soldiers have been engaged in near daily skirmishes with Hezbollah since October, but Israeli leaders on Monday warned they might escalate their campaign. In other news, the House is expected to vote today on a six-month funding plan that is likely to fail, with less than 2 weeks left to prevent a partial shutdown starting October 1st. Speaker Mike Johnson's spending bill includes a controversial proposal that would require people to show proof of citizenship when they register to vote. House Democrats remain overwhelmingly opposed to the plan, and at least a dozen Republican lawmakers are also expected to vote against it. Requiring new voters to provide proof of citizenship has become an election year priority for the Republicans, even though it is already illegal for non-citizens to vote, and research has shown that voter fraud is extremely rare. A government shutdown could mean over 100,000 workers will be put on furlough just weeks ahead of the election. And Senate Republicans voted yesterday to block a bill that would guarantee access to in vitro fertilization nationwide. Republicans already blocked the same bill earlier this year. The Right to IVF Act would establish a statutory right for individuals to access in vitro fertilization treatments and increase affordability for fertility care by requiring insurers to both private and public health care plans to cover treatments. Yesterday's vote is part of